Hi, folks. My name is Chris, and I'm the artist and co-founder at Explorer Maps.
Hi, this is Vanessa, Chris's wife. I have been a number one fan of Chris's art since I first met him in the late 1990s. Which map will you get to help you treasure your own special times? Please be sure to use the promo code Mandela for a discount when you visit exploremaps.com.
Welcome to The Trail Less Traveled, an adventure radio series and podcast dedicated to collecting stories and sounds from around the world in order to take you back to mankind's earliest form of entertainment, storytelling. This episode was recorded on location in collaboration with Explorer Maps. Missoula, Montana is a mecca for outdoor enthusiasts, and each week we will bring you tales of adventure from both near and far, as well as information and inspiration and a few tunes to set the mood. You can subscribe to the podcast and learn about our international outreach projects at traillesstraveled.net. And now, here's your host, international expedition guide, conservationist, and yogi, Mandela.
Today, The Trail Less Traveled is being recorded in Sitka, Alaska. We're looking out at the Gulf of Alaska and Mount Edgecombe, the volcano in the distance. The sun is beginning to set. You can see scattered fishing boats off the coast, and I just spent some time in the underwater world looking at salmon and starfish and just the ecosystem below the surface. This is a place of abundance. One of the more beautiful phrases I've heard since I've been here is, when the tide is out, the table is set. And I've truly experienced an amazing community of people who live off the land. And I'm sitting with a woman right now whose family has been here since time immemorial. Her name is Louise Brady, and she is a Tlingit woman. Thank you so much for joining me today on The Trail Less Traveled.
Thank you so much for being here, and welcome to Tlingit Ani, to Sitka. It's an honor to have you here.
Louise, will you tell us about your people being in this area and living off the land before the houses were built? You know, we're in a structure right now, but there's a good chance that one of your ancestors sat right where we are now, perhaps after gathering a meal off the rocks that we were staring at below us. And I just would be grateful if you would share a little bit of your knowledge that maybe your parents and grandparents passed down to you about that.
We have a highly complex society. And when the Russians came, when the United States came, we had a food economy. And there were very specific, you know, like I told you, I'm Kiksedi clan, and we settled here. And so what people would call our fish camps or our summer homes were all over the sound. And Sitka Sound is probably one of the most abundant places in Southeast Alaska. I always wondered, there's a map of Tlingit tribes and clans in Southeast Alaska. And we had so many clans here. I was like, why do we have so many more clans here? And I believe it's because of the abundance. And I believe that, you know, really key to that abundance is the herring. Because in the springtime, this place is beautiful year-round. I don't care if it's raining, I don't care if it's snowing, if it's 10 degrees. But in the spring when the herring come, there's really no place like it. A couple of years ago, I was with a friend of mine at the national park, and there are tidal flats. So when the tide is low, it probably goes maybe a quarter of a mile out, and the herring had just come in, so it was March, and we walked out on the flats, and the flats were full of seagulls and eagles and ravens and blue herons, all these different species of ducks, and there were sea lions in the water, there were whales, and everybody came here for the herring. And I told my friend Peter, it's like, this is truly a cacophony of joy. Everybody was eating herring eggs. Everybody was eating herring. It was the most amazing, most beautiful sight. And again, I feel so blessed that I could be there, and I can imagine my ancestors. When they first came here and they saw this place, you know, what they must have thought. And, you know, having lived here a couple of seasons and to just see the bounty of the herring eggs, the king salmon, the silver salmon, the red salmon, the pink salmon, the clams, the cockles, the whales, the halibut. You know, our smokehouses, our summer houses were actually smokehouses. So we would, you know, in our clans would have these pieces of land that would involve salmon streams and berry bushes. That's the other thing. Oh my gosh. I don't know if, I hope you've been able to taste some of the huckleberries. Huckleberries are so, all the berries.
The salmon berries, I had them. My first day here, I went sea kayaking in the storm on Saturday, and I was worked up an appetite, to say the least.
Yes.
And I went into the forest and had probably the best clam chowder I've ever had.
Yep.
And it was just warm and wonderful. And
yes.
Then for dessert, I walked around the forest for about 30 minutes and ate salmon berries and huckleberries and watermelon berries and blueberries, wild celery, seaweed.
Yes. Oh, I know, right? Black seaweed. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. I mean, you know, we could go out and, just pick the black seaweed off the rocks. And, the berries. It's just amazing. And, I because of the abundance of Southeast Alaska, we were able to develop a highly structured society, as well as art forms, as well as, you know, ways to share the abundance in a really good way. And I do, you know, I do a lot of times, I hike all over off of the road system and beautiful trails. And I think about the different teachings, what people call stories that are in each place. There's this book. The book is pretty good, but the title is awesome. It's called, If This Is Your Land, Where Are Your Stories? If this is your land, where are your stories? I know my stories from here. I know my stories about the salmon boy that disrespected the salmon, and you know what happened to him and the lessons that he had to learn. I know the teachings of the herring lady, you know, who taught us how to respect the herring. I know the story of the woman then who was so selfish and she wouldn't share her knowledge about the herring, and she turned into an owl and flew up the Costaheen or Indian River Valley, and you can still hear her calling sometimes. And a very, you know, very ancient stories, very, very ancient stories and teachings. And I feel so fortunate to be able to walk on the land and to go out and to connect to my ancestors, because it was my ancestors who came here. It's my ancestors that learned how to live on this place and learned how to harvest and gather for thousands of years. And it's challenging, you know, right now I work a lot on herring. They're a keystone species. They're forage fish. And they used to be plentiful. You know, they were in San Francisco. They were all, it's the Pacific herring. It was all throughout the northern Pacific, the Rim of Fire. And there's so few left now. And when I think about, you know, the abundance here, because we used to have thousands of people from other villages come here and harvest herring eggs. That's how many herring there were. This place supported thousands of people. And now it's really, for me, heart-wrenching to hear some of my friends. I didn't know how hard it was getting until I asked a friend of mine if he could share some herring eggs with me. He said, Louise, it's getting too hard. It's getting too hard to find them. This is a big sound. And, you know, this one friend of mine was telling me they'd have to start off in south of the sound. And, you know, most people just, they own skiffs. A lot of people don't have a lot of money. And he said, you know, Louise, we go out and we set the hemlock branches in the water because we see some, you know, herring, and then we go back the next day and there's nothing. Whereas for many years, we could go almost anywhere on the coast of Sitka and any of these islands and set branches, and we're guaranteed to have herring eggs. And my friends would say, you know, they'd have to run all over the sound trying to find the herring, trying to find the herring eggs. And the thing about herring and herring eggs, I hope you get a chance. Everybody should try them. For me, it's like that taste of spring. It's a taste of Southeast Alaska. It's a taste of being Tlingit, because it looks just like caviar, except it's white. And we harvest them on the branches. And every year when they come in, I just take them right off the branches and pop them in my mouth. And there's like this amazing crunch. And
full of nutrients.
It is, absolutely. Absolutely so. So full of nutrients, and they feed. They feed everything. The herring, all of the different salmon species, the whales, the birds. I was talking with somebody earlier today, and there's, I think it's a book called Salmon in the Trees. It really should be Herring in the Trees, because the salmon eat the herring, right?
Yep, and that's what makes it a keystone species.
Exactly.
Louise, I was wondering if you could look out at that beautiful view. The sun is coming through the water where I'm looking, and it's making the water as bright as the belly of a silver salmon.
Yes.
And I'm just wondering if you could paint the picture for whoever's listening out there as to what you're looking at when you look out to this place of abundance.
On the beach right in front of us, there's rock formations with lots of seaweed and barnacles, and of course seagulls are always around, and they're on the rocks, and you can hear the soft, the tide, the waves, which is one of the most calming things for me. I love it so much. And yes, a lot of times it is very gray here. And so the Pacific Ocean is off to the west, so we're looking straight out to the Pacific Ocean, and you can see trawlers, the seiners. They're fishing for salmon and all different kinds of fish. And Sitka Sound is dotted with islands, and so it really protects much of the shore. There's a couple of places here that get a little bit of surf, and you see people surfing sometimes. And then mostly covered by clouds is Tluch, or Mount Edgecombe, and Camelback, or what we call Tluch Yatke. You can't even see it because of the cloud cover. And then, yes, I just love it when the sun comes through and you see the brightness on the ocean, that, yes, that silver. That was a great explanation. And, you know, it's like everybody's, there's a sailboat, and this is the place to be on the water. It's kind of like no matter where you go, in Sitka, it's beautiful. No matter where you go in Sitka, it's beautiful.
A friend of mine recently said, I'm glad you see the beauty in it. I laughed out loud. It's everywhere.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Louise, I was wondering if you could share with us how your people came here, because you've mentioned a couple times they came here.
Yes.
And so we're on an island, Baranof Island.
Yes.
The only way to get to Sitka is via airplane or boat.
Yes.
And so I was wondering how your people came to be living on this island.
Okay, so I told you I'm Kiksadi, and our Tlingit people, we have stories of migration following the last ice age, that we came from the interior of Canada down the river valleys after the last ice age. And so the Kiksadi, my clan, we ended up coming down this Stikine River to what is now Wrangell. And so a number of our people stayed there in a place called Kicks Bay. So that's where the name Kicksetti comes from. And then there was another group of us that moved on and ended up coming, I would imagine, in canoes in after the last ice age. My understanding, too, is that Tlugh Manetchkum was still active, so that we actually settled a little bit further north in, I think it's Catlian Bay, in a place called Dachet. And yes, so we've been here a long time.
And when you said they came via boat, oh, I see, I think a seal out there just surfaced. I mean, everywhere you look, there's a salmon jumping or a sea otter or... There yes. he is. There's a seal. Is that a seal? Sea lion?
Yes, I see it. Oh, I bet you that's a sea lion.
Did your people eat sea lion? That was an animal they harvested?
You know what? I'm not sure. I know seal for sure, mm-hmm. but it wasn't really probably at the top of the list. I do know that we use sea lion whiskers in one of our ceremonial headdresses.
Oh, wonderful.
Yes. Oh, look.
What are you looking at?
Just the seagulls taking off. Oh, my gosh.
Oh, and it's because of the bald eagle. There's a bald eagle swooping
Whoa.
In. Oh, my gosh.
They chase each other around.
We're watching a bald eagle chasing a seagull. Wow. Well, that's where we are in Sitka on the trail less traveled. I wish you guys were here. Beautiful bald eagle just flew within feet of where we're sitting.
Gosh.
I was sea kayaking the other day in relatively rough seas.
Yes.
And I'm an experienced sea kayaker. I was with another friend and we're comfortable with the wind and the waves.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually saw a family of sea otter who had tied their babies to the giant sea kelp so that they wouldn't get separated. And we gave them a lot of space so they didn't get separated in the storm. But we were reflecting off of how cool sea kayaks are, that you can go on really rough seas with them, and that they were actually originally built for hunting.
Mm-hmm.
Were they dugout canoes, do you know? Or were they sea kayaks made with a whalebone and hide?
No, the kayaks actually came from the Aleutic and the Inupiaq up north. Here we had the dugout canoes. And the smaller canoes actually... Tommy Joseph, the utilitarian canoes, right, were made out of spruce. They were carved from spruce trees. And there's more people starting to carve those now. I would love to have one, and I think it would be great to go out harvesting in a canoe, a spruce canoe. And then, then there were the seagoing canoes. And actually, we traded for those, for the seagoing canoes, because our trees up here weren't big enough, so we would go south and trade, like the Haida people, for the larger canoes. Because we traded, we had to have those, because our people traded, all the way down to California. We went California, that's where we got our abalone for a lot of the carvings that you see, and then up north, up to Copper River for the copper. So there was a long, long trade route that we needed to access.
Wow. I have many questions for you about herring and that keystone species and more wildlife questions, but I would love to talk to you about totem, the story of the totem.
Kutia. Mm-hmm. So that's another interesting fact. We have Totem Park, but those were all actually brought here from Prince of Wales Island and by the territorial governor Brady. And because, again, the trees, the cedar trees, the red cedar trees are further south, and the really large trees needed for the kutias, for the totems, are found further south. Up here, we have what we call house posts, right? It kind of be like, how people might put little plaques on, their last names, the Bradys. We had house posts that were carved with our crests so that when people would, because all of our clan houses were on the shore, on the water. And so when people were coming up in their canoes, we had canoe rocks that you could pull the canoes up. You'd know which relatives you were going to see by the house posts that were in front of the clan house.
So were there frogs on yours?
Most likely, yes. Yes.
Because when I met you, I was looking at your jewelry.
Yes, yes.
And you said that you're connected with the frog.
Yes, that's our crest.
And the herring.
Yes, yes.
When I'm in Australia, I realize just how unique every single tribe I've interacted with is there. So I spend a lot of time with Indigenous Aboriginal Australians, and there's over 400 different mobs or you know, they call themselves mobs because some of them see the kangaroo as a brother and sister, you know, and the kangaroo is a mob of kangaroos, so they call themselves sometimes mobs.
Oh, I love it.
You know, when you're with someone whose kangaroo is their brother or their sister, you wouldn't harvest a kangaroo with them.
Yes.
It would be a very big deal.
Yes.
So it's quite something to generalize that they're all going to tell their stories the same way.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, is it totem used throughout all of Alaska?
No. No, it's specifically Northwest Coast, right? So that would be considered Tlingit, which we are mainly in Alaska, but there's also inland Tlingit people up some of the river valleys in northern southeast Alaska, Haida, Tsimshian, and then all the way down into, you know, lower British Columbia. Yes.
How long does it take to carve a totem? I mean, you know, that's they can be big.
Yes. Yeah, I would say, you know, a lot that I've seen are taking maybe 6 months to a year. Yes. And it's really carving is coming back. It's coming back. There's a lot more people learning how to carve. There's a lot more people learning, you know, the language. Especially, you know, here in Sitka, we were affected early on by Westerners because of Dr. Sheldon Jackson. And there was a really big push early on for assimilation. So it's really good to see so many people, you know, learning to carve again, also learning the language, learning our language again, weaving, another really beautiful, beautiful form. Because we used mountain goat wool and the inner bark of the cedar. If you get a chance to go, they're called Chilkat robes. And we have been weaving them for maybe a little over 200 years, and the technique was a gift from the Tsimshian. But it's really amazing because, you know, you have to get the mountain goat. It takes three mountain goats to make enough wool for one robe, and then you get the red cedar. I spun some warp, which is the yarn or that hangs down when you're weaving the ceremonial robes. And it probably takes maybe 2,000 hours to finish a robe, about a year to finish a robe. And they're so beautiful. You can find, sadly, a lot of them were collected. So they're in museums all over the country, all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And they survived more than the robes that predate them because of the cedar, right? Because the cedar protected them from moths. And so most of them that you see are 200 years old at least.
Wow.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you that, actually, because in this day and age, it seems like Gore-Tex is used a lot in wet environments. You know, see people now, the traditional footwear is extra tough.
Yes.
Well, what was the traditional footwear that your ancestors were wearing before Gore-Tex and extra toughs were invented?
You know, depending, I suppose it was barefoot or moccasins. And as far as the waterproof is red cedar. Red cedar capes, you know, you'll see that further south. Red cedar hats, I told you about that. Mm-hmm. I'll find one for you.
Oh, man, I'm a hat girl, so.
I know.
Wow. Well, we're sitting here in Sitka, Alaska, on the Trail Less Traveled with Louise Brady.
So that was it. I don't know if they were able to hear, if you were able to hear. The Coast Guard helicopter, we get a lot of those because basically, you know, there's the Coast Guard air station here, and maybe sometimes people will either have to call from a village to get a medevac. That's a form of a medevac from a smaller village, or people, you know, are on boats having a problem. So there's a lot of traffic of that.
I've heard, actually, yeah. I think we can see the airport right now from where we are, and it's on the water, and it seems to be pretty active with search and rescue.
Yes.
I'll have to come back and interview the search and rescue people.
Yes.
I'm sure they've got some good stories.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I'm sitting here with Louise Brady. She's a Tlingit woman whose ancestors have been here since time immemorial. And when we come back, we're going to talk about a keystone species that's very close to her heart. It's called the herring. But it's time for another song. Potentially a song that reminds you of life here in Sitka.
Life in general. Life has been particularly hard, I think, for a lot of people. I think there's a lot of people who are hurting and in pain right now. And something for me that's always been important is, you know, I guess I'm considered an elder by some, but my life has not always been easy. And I feel so, so blessed that I had some wonderful people in my life when I needed them who were very patient and compassionate and kind when I couldn't be. And so one of my favorite songs, it's by Native Women's a cappella group called Eulalie, and it's called All My Relations. It's really, really beautiful, and I think that that's how it's how we should all be approaching the world right now, with love and compassion and patience.
To our elders who teach us of our creation and our past, so we may preserve Mother Earth for ancestors yet to come, we are the land.
This is dedicated to our relatives before us thousands of years ago, and to the 150 million who were exterminated across the Western Hemisphere in the first 400 years' time, starting in 1492.
To those who have kept their homelands, and to the nations extinct due to mass slaughter, slavery, deportation, and disease unknown to them, and to the ones who are subjected to the same treatment today.
To the ones who survived the relocations and the ones who died along the way.
To those who carried on traditions and lived strong among their people.
To those who left their communities by force or by choice and for generations no longer know who they are.
To those who search and never find. To those that turn away the so-called non-accepted. To those that bring us together. And to those living outside, keeping touch, the voice for many.
To those that make it back to live and fight the struggles of their people. To those that give up and those who do not care. To those who abuse themselves and others. And those who revive again. To those who are physically, mentally, or spiritually incapable by accident or by birth.
To those who seek strength in our spirituality and ways of life, and those who exploit it, even our own.
To those who fall for the lies and join the dividing lines that keep us fighting amongst each other.
To the outsiders who step in, good or bad, and those of us who don't know better.
To the leaders and prisoners of war, politics, crime, race, and religion, innocent or guilty.
To the young, the old, the living, and the dead,
to our brothers and sisters and all living things across Mother Earth,
and her beauty we've destroyed and denied the honor that the Creator has given each individual.
The truth that lies in our hearts, all my relations.
It was while we were living internationally, about 11 years ago, that Explorer Maps first started, when Chris and his brother Greg decided to join forces and bring the maps to the whole wide world. Hi, this is Vanessa, Chris's wife. Each map is a labour of love, and I am lucky enough to see them all grow step by step from the early research and planning stages onto a large white piece of paper, through penciling, inking, and finally seeing the real magic happen as Chris adds the colour. As each one reaches the end phase, I get to examine them closely in the hope that I spot any unfinished bits before Chris sends them off. But there's always new illustrations to see every time. I love going to the Missoula warehouse when we're in Montana to see each unique map on the incredible range of products that Explorer Maps now has. Having lived away from home and families for the past 17 years, our aim of connecting people and place is very poignant to me. And for that reason, my favorite maps are Flathead and the Maasai Mara, because these two places are central to our extended family gatherings and where we have made the best of memories. Which map will you get to help you treasure your own special times? Please be sure to use the promo code Mandela for a discount when you visit exploremaps.com.
Today, the trail less traveled is being recorded in Sitka, Alaska. We are looking out at Sitka Sound, and the sun is setting, although the sun, I don't know if it's really ever setting. It seems to be light a little bit in the night.
Once we're on the downside of summer solstice, it feels like it goes really fast.
Yeah.
But, I mean, summer solstice, it's probably light till 1, and then it gets a little bit dark, and then the sun rises like at 3 mm-hmm. in the morning, 4 in the morning. Yeah. Which is why nobody really ever wants to rest in the summer, and especially right now because we're all going, oh, it's almost here.
Yeah.
The end.
Louise Brady, her ancestors have been here in Sitka Sound since time immemorial, and there is a species in particular that she's very close to, frog being one of them, but the herring another, and wow, there's a humpback whale right out there. There's two islands out there.
Yes.
And then it's right in the middle. I just saw it spout.
Oh,
it's, I think it's swimming towards the volcano. So there's a humpback whale.
But you just love it.
And the humpback whale is one of the species that eats herring.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. So while we're watching the humpback whale, I would love for you to introduce us to a herring, for someone listening who doesn't know what a herring is and its significance for your people, for that humpback whale out there, and for many, 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 many species, which makes it a keystone species, which means when a keystone species goes away, everyone suffers.
Yes.
Sometimes keystone species are not necessarily, I don't know, lack of a better word, the sexy species, you know.
Right.
Right?
Yes.
But they're very important. So I was wondering if you could introduce us to the herring, how they're significant to your people and to all the wildlife in the area, and some of the work that you're doing to protect them.
Oh. I introduced myself as Kachatasha, which is herring lady. And in our history, if you ever spend fall and a winter here, about January, it feels like it's never going to end because it's so dark and it's so rainy. You know, in modern days, you know, when I was working full time, you go to work and it's dark and you come home and it's dark, and we get 90 inches of rain a year, and a lot of that is like in the fall. It seems like it's never ending. And then in January, it starts, you know, getting a little lighter, and the eagles usually leave. They start leaving in the fall time. But in January, I start noticing them be getting out, and there'll be more eagles. There'll be, you know, slowly every week, more and more eagles coming back. And slowly we start gaining light, and then usually by January. So this is how I keep my time, by herring, right? Because in January, by the end of January, when everybody has cabin fever and everybody's absolutely nuts because of the darkness and the rain, I can tell myself, January, February, March, okay, 8 weeks. We can do this for 8 more weeks. 8 more weeks, and the herring are going to be here. And that means, you know, that there's going to be more light. And then usually we have most of the sun, a good bit of sun in the spring. In our history, so the other thing that happens would be happening right around March is that everybody would be coming back out because the sun is coming back out. It's getting a little bit warmer. The constant rain has stopped. And then everybody's getting ready for harvesting. And the harvesting year starts with herring eggs. So everybody was coming out of the clan houses on the beaches and getting ready, you know, whatever their nets or, you know, baskets that they're going to pick their berries in. And so we lived in this close village, right? And it would be maybe a block long. And there were maybe probably 30, 40 clan houses. And so everybody's busy except for this one young lady. And she went to the beach every day, and she sit on this rock, and people are like, oh, what is up? She's just like, probably doesn't want to work, doesn't want to help us, probably being lazy. And what she actually was doing is she was going and she was singing to the herring and inviting the herring to come back to Sitka, back to Sitka. And the herring honored her respect and it was one beautiful sunny day, and she was on that rock, and the tide was coming in, and it was warm, and she fell asleep, and the tide came in, and her long black hair was in the water, and the herring came and laid eggs in her hair. And so that's why we're known as the Herring Ladies, and that's a teaching, and that teaching means that we respect the herring, and we understand that they're here for us, and they're here for this abundance, right? Because there's so many different species of salmon, the whales, you know, the whales come here. It was incredible this spring. There were so many gray whales. I have never seen so many, and the humpback whales. And the salmon rely on the herring. And I just really don't understand how it is that the herring aren't being protected. Just in the last 30 years, so there were, I think, a dozen other herring fisheries in Southeast Alaska, and Sitka is the only one that hasn't collapsed. The one in Auk Bay out of Juneau collapsed in the early, I think, 1980 or 81, and they finally started seeing a few herring in Auk Bay, maybe 2011, 2012. And, you know, because there's herring here, a lot of people come fishing here for salmon, for king salmon. And it used to be, we also have a salmon derby. It used to be really common to catch 50, 60-pound king salmon. Not so much anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, they're getting smaller and smaller. And things are changing, and even though it doesn't feel like it's quick, to me it feels quickly because it's in my lifetime. Mm-hmm. And for things to change that drastically in one lifetime, it's really worrisome. And sometimes I feel like people are like, why do you care about herring so much? Because they are a keystone species, and because if we can't learn how to care for herring, we don't have much of a chance of learning how to care for anything else. They're really, really beautiful. They're really, really beautiful. When the spring comes, it used to be this whole sound. It looked like the Mediterranean. It turns this incredible turquoise color because of all the spawning herring. We have the
goosebumps.
I know, right? We have people saying, yeah, but no, you know, there weren't that many. You know, and the Department of Fish and Game will say, well, yeah, there weren't that many. And I have friends and we have people, you know, they'll come and they'll testify and they'll say, you know, I used to go hang gliding off Gavin Hill or off Harbor Mountain. And yeah, I remember going out and the whole sound was just this beautiful turquoise color. Now there's spots of it here and there. And if it's here, it's, you know, it's out along Kruzov. The gray whales and the humpbacks. There were so many gray whales. And that's the other thing that people will say. It's like, well, how come you're picking on the fishermen? It's like, we're not picking on the fishermen. It's like, these are times where things are changing so much. You know, we all need to work on climate change. We all need to understand what's going on in the ocean. We really need to make some changes so that we can reverse the ocean acidification. We can, you know, at least stop the climate change. But the one thing that we have control over right now is extraction. How much are we taking? And the thing of the herring fishery is that it's not even for the herring, it's for the sackcrow. And so the 25,000 tons that were taken, they took the sackcrow and then they ground up all the rest of the herring to feed to farmed salmon and for pet food. And for our systems to be able to justify that waste doesn't make any sense. One of our elders who testified at the Board of Fish in 1997, he told the Board of Fish, he's like, this doesn't make sense. It would be like going and killing a whole herd of deer just for the female kidney. It's wanton waste.
Makes me think of
our keystone species in Africa, the elephants, and how they're being killed off just for their tusks.
What is wrong with us?
Louise, our common friend, Matt Jackson,
yes,
he told me about the hemlock branches.
Yes.
And he didn't explain it in full length because he said, I must meet you. And then
yes,
you can tell me about how you use the hemlock branches to help the herring lay their eggs. And when you harvest, you only take 9 and you leave 1, always leaving 1. And that's something that I've noticed. We're talking about a web earlier,
yes,
around the world. Plane taking off in the distance, you can probably hear it. To not take everything, to always think about the next harvest, not necessarily your next harvest, but the next harvest for 9 generations from now.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So can you tell us a little bit about how you use the hemlock branches and this concept of always leaving,
yes,
something behind as well?
You know, I mean, that's, you know, a really good lesson, because I think the way that the heron fishery is prosecuted is just take as much as you can. It's maximum sustained yield for, it's a maximum sustained yield way of life. So we end up taking more of things that we need. And I think it's part of living with that intention and that knowledge that I'm not just here living for myself. I'm here living for, yes, for the 7th generation. And so that what I'm doing today, if I'm taking too much, if I take too much today, that means that that is less for my great-great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren. I really believe that, you know, looking out on Sitka Sound and understanding that for thousands of years, this place supported thousands of people with herring eggs, we had something right, because we didn't destroy the herring. We take the eggs. We are careful about when we harvest and where we harvest. The hemlock branches, what we're doing when we're harvesting and making sure that we're not disturbing the herring, making sure that we're quiet, making sure that we're doing all of these things that will assure abundance for the 7th generation. For me, it's becoming more and more of, you know, everyday life. And what is it that I'm doing today? What am I doing today for that generation coming behind me?
Someone out there listening who is getting overwhelmed,
mm-hmm,
by what seems to be bad news, or, and sometimes in conservation it feels like we're pushing a rock uphill.
Yes.
But what inspires you? What can inspire someone listening? What can we do about it?
Oh, you know what? There's so much we can do. I mean, yeah, I was really fortunate. I attended this conference, and I have wonderful friends and wonderful family and friends that are becoming family. Ya'atwune, respect for all things. I think that one of the things that has happened is that people have forgotten to understand that, you know, you are sacred, that the herring are sacred, that everything and everyone around us is sacred. And I think that the only way that we're going to get back to that is to come together. Much of my early life was really characterized by violence, a lot of violence. And really, a lot of people really didn't think I would live to see the age of 30. And here I am, 66. And I really wasn't particularly interested in seeing 30 either. And I think that that gives me a perspective of, you know, I came from hopelessness in my life, and somehow the people around me helped me to find hope. And I think that we need to realize that, you know, we can't find that hope alone, and that we do need to reach out, and we need to be able to create community. In 2018, we had the first Herring Ku'ich ceremony. It was a small group of us. And we had weekly potlucks, some really good food. We had some of the best cooks in Sitka, because we'd have things like, you know, mountain goat pie, or, you know, deer stew, or, yeah. And we made gifts. And we wanted to celebrate the herring. A lot of people were really getting discouraged because we were, you know, 20, 25 years of going to the Board of Fish. And, you know, the elders, our culture bearers, were getting really discouraged. And I went to my elders, and I said, is it okay if we have a herring ceremony? And they're like, what's herring ceremony? I said, well, we'll do a feast, and we will celebrate the herring. For us in ceremony, when we're making gifts, we give gifts to our guests, we invite guests, we give gifts, we feed them, we take care of them. And when we were making the gifts, it's really important to understand that we have to have love, peace, good feelings in our heart when we're working with our hands, when we're going to gift something with somebody. And really nobody knew it. You know, the people that were working together knew what had never been to a kui. And they just said, okay, we'll do this. We prepared, I don't know for how long, but we ended up with over 200 people at the Alaska Native Brotherhood Hall. It was decorated with hemlock branches, and we had herring eggs. We had herring eggs piled up on the table in front of the hall. We sang, we danced, we didn't have to limit our talks to 3 minutes. People got to talk as long as they needed to about how important herring were to them. It was 12 hours of celebrating herring. Everybody should do that. Everybody should set aside time to celebrate what you love. Let us celebrate what we love and who we love, because this world is too... There's so much despair and so much hopelessness. We have to have that intention. We need to set that intention to celebrate each other.
That is the voice of Louise Brady. We're sitting here in Shika, Alaska.
Yes. Yes.
What does Shika mean?
So she is the name of the island.
Okay.
And that's the name. Shika. It's the branch.
Shika means
on the
branch.
Outside of the branch, yeah.
The outside of the branch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because we're on the outside of the island, right?
Okay.
Yeah. We're the only one in Southeast, actually, that's on the ocean like this. All the other ones are inland, all the other villages.
What song would you like to end your show with?
What They'll Say About Us. I walk a lot, and I was up on Harbor Mountain. Beautiful. You have to go up. It was this just incredibly beautiful day. And there wasn't a cloud in the sky, and I was walking with my grand dog. And I think a lot. I think a lot about, you know, what world, what am I leaving my son and my grandchildren? And it's a fairly new song, and I had just heard it. And it's basically, what will they say about us and what we're doing today? You know, with all of the upheaval, and you know, trying to encourage others to say, you know, we can do this, because you know, I think everybody's overwhelmed, and this conference that I was at, one of the speakers was saying, you know, the scale of the problem is huge. The scale of the problem, right? It's capitalism. It's unfettered greed, and so many people are looking for a solution that meets the scale of the problem. But he said, what if we're already winning? As he said, I've been traveling all over and people everywhere organizing, and we have all these small scale solutions by these communities, right? It's that act locally. So what if we put all of these small-scale solutions on the other side of the scale, and guess what, you know? What if we're winning?
Namaste, Missoula. Mandela here, your host of The Trail Less Traveled, the Trail 1033's locally harvested adventure radio series. The show premieres every Sunday evening at 6 Mountain Time. And you can stream the show live online at trail1033.com. The show is also a podcast, available everywhere. My adventure tip this week is remember to invest in solid layers. My favorite layers are 100% merino wool because they don't stink and they often stay warm when they're wet. So when you're in a wet environment like Southeast Alaska,
Be sure to layer up with wool and some Gore-Tex or some layer that will keep you dry. I would like to end the show by extending gratitude to a small family business based in Missoula, Montana, who recently partnered with the Trail Less Traveled in order to connect people and place. That small family business is Missoula's very own Explorer Maps. Explorer Maps has over 60 hand-drawn story maps. They donate a percentage of everything sold back to the conservation of these public lands. Be sure to pencil in our next Cartography Comes Alive event with the Clark Fork Coalition on April 17th. That's it for this week's adventure, my friends in Missoula and around the world. But until next week, please remember, conservation isn't a spectator sport. Get informed, get engaged, and speak up on behalf of wildlife and wild places.